This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Yeah! welcome to the Solar Storm. Thank you so much for joining me here this Sunday night, December 28th, 2014, the last Solar Storm of 2014. Right here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com, the one and only. Others have tried to emulate what we do, but with little success, in my opinion. This is a unique network with lots of fantastic hosts and also wild card hosts. Nick, most recently, doing a great job, and awesome callers and commenters. So big thank you out there to the Renegade community. The lineup has been rather static of late. It changed a lot in 2014. But as of right now, we have myself on Sundays, of course. Mondays, we have the wild card. Tuesdays, the return of Tier with Drew. Wednesdays, Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman. Thursday, we have Insights from an Observer with an Observer. Friday, we have Aristocracy of Blood, formerly Imperium Europa, with Dana Antiochus. And Saturdays, we have the Roundtable with various hosts, with Drew filling in last night fantastically. Good to see him back and at it. And we'll have a whole lot of new shows coming in 2015. I don't know exactly what 2015 will bring in terms of shows, but I'm sure it will be interesting. 2014 is going to be the topic for tonight, and then I'll get into a little bit of what I see coming in 2015, what we can enable to happen in 2015. 2014 was a huge year for us. A lot of ups and downs, but this is when we really went to the big time. 2013 was definitely an interesting year. This is when Renegade Broadcasting was really starting to hit stride. We began late in 2012, so we're a little over 2 years old. And 2013, we had some big shakeups, a lot of drama here and there, a whole different assortment of hosts, and some really good shows, some mediocre shows, and some other shows. But all in all, I was very pleased with 2013. We had the Renegade Roadshow at the end of 2013, and that was very exciting. That documentary is up on YouTube. I'm eventually going to put together all of the three different parts, fix a few little problems. It's already done. And then upload it to YouTube. I thought that was a pretty important documentary. It showed us getting together in the real world, making things happen. We met some interesting people as well. And that really laid the groundwork for 2014. This year, the year of the 14 words. That's at least what I called it at the end of 2013. My last show in 2013 was titled A Year in Review and the 14 words in 2014. At that point, the White Man March had already been set, the date was set. Plans were underway. So I really wanted to make sure that the 14 words were first and foremost on our agenda in 2014. Now I'm just actually going to go through the timeline here real briefly and go through some of the shows that I did on this network last year. First show in the new year, I had Angelo John Gage on. Doing a fill-in show on a Monday night. And that used to be a night I went on. I've had a couple different nights that I do here in the network. And I had the Blitzkrieg broadcast at the point, not the Solar Storm, for any of you that are not too familiar. Go check out the archives. Lots of good shows for myself and the other hosts in the archives. Just click on a host picture up top and you'll get right to their shows. Then I did Golden Dawn of the Black Sun. So I was talking about the occult. This is a solo show. Superhuman abilities, Vril energy, Third Reich explorations, and other such things. I then had Dana Antiochus, General Antiochus, on the next show. Then I talked to John Friend. And then I had Horus the Avenger back on. Then I talked to Jimmy Marr about his activism, which got even bigger in 2014. After I spoke to him at that point, I then talked to Tom in Connecticut and Dave Mansfield about psychological operations. I talked to Keith from Truth Militia. I did a solo show about subversion, reactionary radicalism, white consciousness, and other such things. And then I was interviewed by John Friend. I was interviewed by Nick from Circus Maximus the first time. I talked to Merlin Miller, who was the presidential candidate for the American Third Position in 2012. I spoke with Eric Hunt from then the Jewish Gas Chamber hoax site, but now he has Holocaust Hoax Museum. That's what he's doing, and he has a new film out as well. And then talked to Laura from Bugs and Tom from National Action. This was right before the White Man March, and I'll get to that later. After the White Man March, I was again interviewed by John Friend on the Realist Report. I spoke to Paul Fromm from Canada. Then I did a solo show about the anti-white administration, their stated goals of really what we've seen unfold now, race war, and the radical revolutionary agenda that was made clear by Obama's cohorts in the Weather Underground about killing newborn white babies. You hear it all the time, the Black Panther rhetoric, and in other of these revolutionary black circles. And they're doing it, and they want to do more of it. So, yeah, we'll have to deal with that in 2015. And we will. My next guest was Olaf Childress, editor of the First Freedom newspaper. I got sent a copy of this very good newspaper. I really enjoyed reading through that. It's somewhat special to get a real newspaper in your hands with our kinds of ideas in them. After that, I spoke to Richard Tidor, who wrote Hitler's Revolution. This is a very good book and a very interesting interview that you might want to check out if you want to know more of the story of the Third Reich and how subversion was crucial to thwarting them at every single move. You had people in high places who were actively working against the interests of Germany. And it was time and time again we've learned that they were making sure that the war effort did not go as planned. These were traitors of the highest order. And we talked about all the great things that National Socialist Germany did, strength through joy and things like that, the economic miracle. After that, I did a show about the Glenn Miller shooting and what nonsense that was. Then I did a show on remoralization, not demoralization. And the reason I had to do this show is because after the successes of White Man March 1 and White Man March 2, and I'll get to that later, I was completely under attack. And you out there, the listener or participant in the White Man March, were also under attack we were being demoralized because we were making things happen a little too quickly. So the subversives, the traitors, the plants were doing every single thing they could to make us more divided, to get us to doubt one another, and to get us to stop being active. I took some time off after this show. Almost a couple months, a month and a half, maybe a little less. In the meantime, I put together some programs that can be found in the wildcard section of the site on topics of such as cultural Marxism. That was one. I did one on the aquatic ape theory. What I did was I put together a whole bunch of different audio clips, and I did just a little bit of narration, tying them all together, presenting a somewhat clear picture, as clear as I could get it, using a number of different sources. I did one on South Africa, one on Varvith Vikernes, and a few others, to be sure. I came back with a show titled Jesus 2.0. I talked about the idea of positive Christianity, such as it was termed in the Third Reich. The Savior, the Lord and Savior Vladimir Putin, Rabbi Fallatio, and much more. That's how I listed that description. I then talked to Dr. Kevin MacDonald again. And I spoke with Lee Rogers of the Daily Slave after that. Talked to Don Advo, co-host of Stormfront Radio, about the legal system after that. I then talked about the Third World War, the war that's being waged by having the Third World flooding into all white countries. I then talked to Lana Lochtev from Red Ice Creations, Alternative Solutions for European Problems. I had Eric Hunt back on the show, 20th Century Hoax. That's what you'll see at the beginning of the videos that he does. I think it's great, 20th Century Hoax. We talked about the Treblinka archaeology hoax and also the Holocaust Hoax Museum, which was just launched. After that, I spoke with Henrik Palmgren of Red Ice Creations. Talked about the Nordic model, multiculturalism, the war on whites. And I really think that Henrik and Lana have done an incredible amount of good for our cause in 2014. So a big tip of the fedora. I'm just kidding with that. Tip of the hat, although I don't usually wear hats, to Henrik and Lana of Red Ice Creations. I then did another solo show, Hitler 2.0, Der Führer is back. I talked about Adolf Hitler, Israel's war against the Goyim, the Samson option, Zogbox, the Wandering Jew, Wotan the Wanderer, and much more. I talked to Adam and Garth of the Kraz Files. I suggest you check out their latest show, especially, but check out all their shows at the Kraz Files. You can find them on Podomatic and linked up in the description. And the last show that they did was with Tom Goodrich and myself. And I think it was a pretty important show, so please do give a listen to that. I did a special fill-in show on perversity, pornography, and pedophilia to discuss what American children are learning in school these days. I spoke to Wodinson of Northern Runes Radio. If you're interested in runes, the Norse traditions, Ausatru, I suggest you go listen to this show. This one's for you. Talked to Jimmy Marr again about continuing the fight against white genocide. I talked to Jason Erb from Exposing Faux Capitalism about the monetary system. And we know who controls that, don't we? Those stinking Eskimos. I call them snow Mexicans. Charles Kraft, the artist, the ceramic artist. We talked about the Coudenhove Kalergi plan, practical idealism, cultural degeneracy, and much more. I then spoke to our good friend Robert Ransdell, right as he was launching his With Jews We Lose campaign and announcing the White Guard. Spoke to Sean from Two's Company, Three's Allowed, another Australian. And he does a show most nights, so do check that out. I talked about Jim Traficant, who had recently died back then in September. Did a little tribute show to him. And then spoke about the Black Death, ISIS, zombies, Zogbots, Untermensch, Ebola, and other related topics. I had Thomas Goodrich back on the show, second time, talking about Hellstorm and the upcoming documentary. And now is a good enough time to mention that there is a preview that has been released over at hellstormdocumentary.com. Go over and check out hellstormdocumentary.com. There is a preview titled The Rape of Germany. Please watch it. After that, I talked about vampires. Yes, those bloodsuckers and how they relate to our chosen tribe. Our chosen tribe, who has been accused of blood libel so many times throughout the ages. Yahweh's favorite. Yes, I spoke to Dennis Wise again, creator of Adolf Hitler, Their Greatest Story Never Told. I had interviewed him, and I had interviewed Thomas in 2013 as well. There's just so much to go through if you really want to catch up on all the Renegade. But you know what? I recommend it. Go find the ones that you think are compelling. It's so many shows over the years. Yes, I talked about White Hot Heresy. Again, this was something of a sequel to Golden Dawn of the Black Sun. Talking about the Black Sun again, belief in our blood, what power really means, achieving victory, things like that. Then Horus the Avenger came back on the show. Maybe the fifth time I've had him on. He just has a lot to say. I thought this was a very good show. Did almost a whole hour on Nazi Never Never Land, which I thought was some far out but fascinating material. I then did a movie night. I hope you enjoy reliving 2014 with me as I advertise my previous shows. I talked about the movies, pro-white movies or movies that somehow might be of interest to you. Talked to Stan Hess, longtime pro-white advocate, about our favorite topics, illegal invaders, multicultural America, Ferguson, Jews, Negroes in America, Africans in America, not African Americans. I've heard somebody else put it this way. I like it. Africans in America. I talked to John Kaminsky about the criminal conspiracy. These are the recent ones. Then I did a show on the Annenerbe, the group in National Socialist Germany investigating our ancestry through archaeology, linguistics, religions, symbols, the occult, and more. And last week I spoke to Gerhard Eilsmeier, who was born in East Germany and grew up under the Soviet boot, but was able to escape. All right, I've gone through that. So that was the year at the Solar Storm. Renegade as a whole had a very big year as well. All right, this is going to be a call-in show. So if you want to call in at any point to discuss 2014 or 2015, what you consider to be the most important events in it, as it relates to Renegade, as it relates to your life, as it relates to the world at large. And give us some predictions for 2015. I think that 2014 was the year that we start to really destroy diversity, this notion of diversity as being our greatest strength. The way that the year unfolded was really that our activists went out there, some great people, and they made it clear to as many people as they could that diversity is destroying us. We did it in a peaceful manner. One of our activists was attacked. That was the most violence that we saw. People out there looking good, good-looking signs, spreading their message, loving their people. And then what happened later in the year with all of this black mob violence? Well, this has been happening for years and years and years, but it really came to the forefront for a lot of people. A lot of people are having to stare diversity right in the face and realize that it's not what it's cracked up to be. It's not all peaches and cream. Oh, the big rainbow. It's so lovely. Yeah. Then that liberal gets punched right in the teeth, sees his daughter being raped or whatever, and he starts to change his mind. Some of them don't. He just did that and pickpocketed me because, you know, not pickpocketed. He just beat me over the head and stole my wallet, lit me on fire. It's because of systemic oppression, okay? It's because of white slavery in years past. It's just such a horrible thing. I only wish I could have been more to that young man. He was really getting his life together. He was a good boy. The police officer didn't have to shoot him. Of course he was pointing a gun at the police officer's head, but it wasn't loaded. He's poor. The police officer should have known that. Oh, these racist cops. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yes. Whereas I was vilified, I was deemed the most hateful white supremacist for stating the obvious, what should be obvious, and advocating a peaceful action. This was the biggest taboo. You're not supposed to do that. Then we have, most recently in 2014, people calling for murdering cops out there on the streets, having it happen, lighting white people on fire, racial hatred, killing people with hammers, raping old women, raping little kids, killing each other as they always do, but maybe just a little bit more. All sorts of anti-white violence, stoked on by that MSNBC presenter, the promoter of anti-white hatred, Al Sharpton, and of course, Barack Obama, Eric Holder, and the rest of them, and all of the kosher media. Oh, it's got a stamp of approval on it. It means it's good. It's healthy for you. Don't you just love that our rabbis bless our media so that you can consume it and be a good little goy? Yes. Yes. I got on the kosher media. That happened in 2014. You know, actually, Dana got on the kosher media actually the same exact program right before myself. I've got a couple of audio clips I'm going to play here. No, not this one. Yeah, Dana called into NPR as well, talked about Israel being a parasite. That one was really good. First, what I will do is play this other clip of Dana calling into Tom Hartman. Short one. I'm doing this all on the fly, folks. I was going to do a well-researched show, but I didn't have enough time, so I'm doing this one instead. I'm saving those notes for later, for 2015. Okay. Here we have it. Yes. Dana Antiochus confronts Jewish privilege on RT. That's what this is titled. Get this going here. Yes.
Well, many times. What it does is it demonstrates the amount of space between the Klan and Donald Trump and the others who are saying, we got proof that it's right there on Glenn Beck's website. We've got proof that Obama was actually a citizen of Indonesia. It's all about, this tells me, and I hope it tells you, the nature of these arguments. These arguments are essentially racist. They're fearful. These are, fear-based arguments. And how do you evaporate that? You evaporate it by exposing it. Dana in New Britain, Connecticut. Hey, Dana, what's on your mind tonight?
Hey, Tom. This is Dana from RenegadeBroadcasting.com. I just wanted to say quickly, I agree with a lot of your positions against the war, against neoconservatism, and just the push for going to war with Iran and all this kind of stuff. But I think the big problem here, and this is the problem with the last guy that you just interviewed, when we speak about white privilege and this kind of thing, how come it's never mentioned that a huge percentage of the money is in the power of a small elite? And, they go by, whether you want to call them Jewish or part of the Judaic religion.
Oh, Dana. It's the Klan calling back.
Yes, and that song that followed it got a lot of people pissed off this year. They really hated that song because I played it over and over again. I thought it was funny. So that was Dana Antiochus calling into Tom Hartman. And now what I'm going to actually do is play a little bit of a longer clip here of my interview with Tom Hartman. It's a short segment. He didn't want to have me on for any longer. And I was on, yes, American television discussing our positions, which is somewhat unprecedented. David Duke gets to do it once in a while. So let's listen in. I could have done it better, okay? But he's a sneaky, tricky little rat.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And you may not have heard about it. You may not know about it. But tomorrow, the 15th of March, if I have this right, is the White Man March. Seriously, whitemanmarch.com is the website. Kyle Hunt is a spokesperson for it. And so let's engage in a little bit of anthropology here and find out what this is all about. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, where is the march and when? All that kind of thing.
The march is all around the world. It's a viral idea, and it's not necessarily a literal march. People are just being asked to go out and do something that is pro-white. This could include holding up signs, passing out literature, or engaging in some other kinds of public demonstrations.
Burning a cross?
No, I don't know why that would be necessary or good publicity.
Well, usually when I think of people who are, you know, promoting white men, I think of the KKK.
Isn't that interesting? Because you talk about white privilege a lot, and we don't actually have anybody out there that's pro-white in our media. And in fact, our media,
except all those white people,
is completely anti-white. Well, it's got a lot of Jewish people. But let me tell you about.
That was a question I have for you, Kyle. I'm on your website. I keep seeing this reference to Jews throughout your website. Are Jews not white people in your mind?
No, and in Jewish minds, white people are not related to them either.
They don't consider white people
Jews, and Jews should not consider Jews white people. Jews, in fact, have been the leading proponents behind the civil rights movement. In fact, the NAACP was led by Jews for much of its existence, and they have been working to undermine white Western civilization in many different ways. A quote by Barbara Lerner Specter is a very ominous one for white people, in which she says that multiculturalism is now coming to Europe and Jews will be blamed for it because they're playing a leading role. They've done the same thing in the United States as well. They are not white. In fact, they are often anti-white.
Okay. So I'm curious, Kyle, when did you realize that as a white guy, you were oppressed?
Well, let me tell you about affirmative action, in which white people, and there are a lot of poor white people. Have you ever been to Appalachia?
I have.
White people are being oppressed in that they are victims of racism and discrimination. They are targeted and not allowed to have certain jobs and are not allowed to get into the same kinds of educational institutions as people who are less qualified than them are. And it's based solely on the color of the skin. The fact that they are white hinders them from getting the same kinds of opportunities
including
illegal immigrants often, are able to get.
Okay. I'd still like to get back to the question, if you don't mind, and I don't mean this, I genuinely am not going to pick on you or ridicule you or anything like that. I was just curious if you could share with us, you know, your personal story of what was the epiphany for you that caused you to realize that you or that white people like you are oppressed.
Are in danger?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how about when Jamie Foxx is on Saturday Night Live and he says, "I kill all the white people in the movie." How great is that? And then
in Django,
the audience applauds. Yeah, he's promoting Django Unchained. Let's talk about another movie that recently came out, 12 Years a Slave. They're continuously bringing up this idea that every white person today needs to be collectively punished for the sins of slavery. Now, at the height of slavery, only 1.4% of all American whites actually owned slaves. And there were, in fact, many Jews, blacks, and American Indians who also owned slaves, but you're never going to see this represented in the movies or in the textbooks. And I don't know if you know this history, but there were a lot of white slaves in the colonies as well, right up until mainly white people fought to end the practice of slavery. But we don't get a whole lot of credit. They don't make inspirational stories about all the white people who fought to end the...
Are you talking about the people who came over from Europe on indentures, lifetime indentures, who were
indentured servants, and mm-hmm. oftentimes those indentured servants were treated worse than the black slaves. But there were 300,000 Irish slaves alone who were brought to the colonies. And this is never discussed. I'm part Irish myself, and I think it's a tragedy that
the Irish slaves were able to blend in, assuming that your statement is accurate. I can't verify that, but I do know that there were people of all colors, including white people, who were essentially slaves, and in some cases overtly
slaves.
But within a generation, or if they could get away, they could blend into the Uber culture, into the larger culture, and nobody would question them, whereas somebody with black skin couldn't do that.
Let's talk about the slaves in Europe. About 1.5 million slaves were kidnapped and taken as slaves in bondage by the North Africans, the Barbary Pirates. I'm not sure if you know about that history. It was going on around the same time as African slave trade. And
But to this moment right now, Kyle, when did you realize that you were oppressed? What has motivated you to participate in this?
Because my people are being denigrated at every possible turn. The white man is being displaced, ridiculed, and...
How has this affected you in your life?
Well, because I'm not allowed to even express my love of my race, my pride in our accomplishments. Can you imagine...
You're on the air right now talking to 3 million people. I mean, I'm not stopping you.
Well, as soon as somebody does express a pride in their race, if they're white, and only if they're white, then they're called a racist, a Nazi, a bigot, a white supremacist, a Klansman, as you've insinuated.
Well, don't you think that you are a white supremacist?
No, what have I said that has indicated that I consider white people to be able to lord supreme over everybody else?
Okay, so you don't think that other races are inferior to whites?
I love my race, and I'm willing to discuss our accomplishments and some of our downfalls and some of the sore points of our history that often go completely.
So if you don't mind, Kyle, I'm just again. You know, I get it that, you know, some white guy in a community that has a lot of people of color in it who didn't get a job might think that he was racially discriminated against, or might even have been racially discriminated against.
That's affirmative action.
And would go, yeah, exactly, and would go off on it. What happened to you? What brought you into this?
I saw that there is a genocide taking place, Tom. You can look at the UN's definition of genocide, which is first killing members of the group, or in whole or in part, two, causing a serious bodily harm or mental harm.
So white people are being killed.
Three, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Any of these conditions, if they're met, it constitutes.
So how are white people being killed in a way that is genocide?
That does not need to even be the case. But I'll tell you what, Tom, white people are the victims of black-on-white crime at 39 times the rate of white-on-black crime. There's a serious epidemic going on in which white people are being targeted
You're afraid of black people.
I'm not afraid of black people. I'm talking about federal crime statistics, which indicate that there is a serious problem going on. Have you not seen this knockout game where white people are being targeted?
Yeah, that Fox News started and has been promoting.
It's never called a hate crime. It's never called a hate crime because, I'll tell you what, we don't have civil rights. White people don't have civil rights. And I'll give you a quote for this. This is from Mary Frances Berry, former chairwoman of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She said, "Civil rights laws were not passed to protect the rights of white men and do not apply to them." This is a civil rights struggle, Tom.
Okay. I find the whole thing fascinating. Kyle Hunt, his website is whitemanmarch.com. Kyle, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks.
Curious your thoughts on Kyle's thoughts.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That was interesting. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the cultural anthropology of this. What causes white people to think like this?
What causes white people to think like this? I wonder. As I said, I could have done that better, but it's not easy. It might have been easier in person, actually, rather than over the phone. But in 10 minutes, you're not really given a whole lot of time, so I try to cram in as much as possible, making emotional appeals and factual appeals. Oh, but all I got was criticism from most of these so-called white nationalists, the real thinkers of our movement, the stinkers. They didn't want anything to do with it, who poo-pooed it. You know, since I'm on a little bit of a clip thing here, I'm just going to finish out this little clip section with the one that I mentioned before, Dana calling into NPR.
And I'm going to move on to the next call because I want to get Dan in here from Cromwell, Connecticut. Hi, Dan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, yeah, this is Dan Antiochus.
RenegadeBroadcasting.com. My question is, with the shifting geopolitical alliances, more particularly this new Cold War we're seeing revved up by the media with Russia, it just seems that the West is spiritually and culturally dead. And with the triumph of plutocratic capitalism in World War II, we have nothing but materialism and decadence. So the elephant in the room is Israel. And I just don't understand, how is this going to fit in with Hamas or Hezbollah, Iran, and what's going on right now with, you know, Russia and the Ukraine? Are we looking at World War III, all because of this parasitic domination over our country? And that's really all I have.
All right, Dan, thank you. Peter Newman, put this into big geopolitical perspective for us.
I think this is possibly the one conflict that you cannot blame Israel for.
What? What did he just say there? That was the most anti-Semitic thing I've ever heard. Rewind.
For us.
I think this is possibly the one conflict that you cannot blame Israel for.
We can blame Israel for every other conflict that's taking place, that has taken place since it came into existence? Wow, this guy in NPR is pretty radical. Even I don't blame Israel for all that. One more time, and then we'll let it play through.
Put perspective for us.
I think this is possibly the one conflict that you cannot blame Israel for. I mean, by no possible means. This is a conflict that has arisen from, as a consequence of the Syrian uprising, as a consequence of the Arab Spring. It has spread into Iraq. It is something that Israel has actually been very quiet on, because from Israel's point of view, there are no good options here. They don't particularly like Bashar Assad. They don't like ISIS. All of them hate Israel. There's no good outcome from Israel's point of view. If they support Bashar Assad, they are empowering Hezbollah, who hates Israel. If they support ISIS or some of the extremists, they are empowering extremists who hate Israel. So from Israel's point of view, there's no good outcome. This is one conflict where you can safely say Israel has not had a hand in creating this conflict.
That guy is blaming Israel for everything. That is a racist anti-Semite. Is that guy a Nazi on NPR? NPR is now hiring Nazis. Jeez. Nazi International, folks. That's what's happening. You know what? Let's finish off the whole white man march section here. I'm going to read a short piece that wrapped up the first white man march, which was followed by the second, which involved what were described as hate bombs. I'm not going to get into all that, but that made it onto the Daily Show, with John Leibovitz, otherwise known as John Stewart. And yeah, you saw diversity equals white genocide Easter eggs and a Hitler Easter bunny on John Stewart's Daily Show. So it was a pretty effective campaign, I'd say. The article here is from American Free Press. First, it describes the podcast I did with Dave Gaharie. And here's the write-up by John Friend. March brings white issues to forefront. Pro-white activists from across nation hail White Man March tremendous success. On March 15, pro-white activists all across the globe, including this reporter, participated in the inaugural White Man March, the march organized by popular radio host, blogger, and activist Kyle Hunt of Renegade Broadcasting was designed to get a specific message out to the public. The message, this is quoting me, the message that diversity equals white genocide is intended to plant seeds in people's minds, getting them to think about how massive immigration and forced assimilation, affirmative action, and diversity quotas, and the anti-white media are all part of the knockout game against white people. Haha, clever, Kyle. Hunt explained in a recent interview with this reporter. And so my voice for this is going to be the deep one, I guess. The march exceeded my expectations in every way, Hunt continued. Pro-white demonstrations happened all around the world. There were actual marches, flyer distributions, big signs, banner drops, stickers, and even a moving billboard on the back of a truck. The white man march was trending worldwide on Twitter, sometimes at number one for almost the entire day. Laura Fitzgerald, an activist who participated in the march in Knoxville, Tennessee, also spoke with this reporter and explained exactly why she wanted to be involved with the march and its message. I can't do a female Australian voice. I jumped on board with the White Man March because it was a day solely focused on telling the world that massive non-white immigration into every white country and only into white countries is genocide, Ms. Fitzgerald said. March 15th was a tremendous success. It was a day pro-whites from all over the globe took part in a coordinated effort under one slogan and declared to the world that there are people who will not tolerate this anti-white system and are united in forcing the conversation worldwide about white genocide. Many alternative, independent, and even mainstream outlets and organizations reported on the march, generating worldwide interest and awareness. The march went off rather smoothly, and most activists reported receiving extremely positive feedback and responses from citizens they interacted with. Almost all activists were able to avoid violent confrontations, which is exactly what we wanted, noted Hunt. News outlets flocked to cover the White Man March, said Hunt. There has been local TV news coverage, and I was interviewed on cable TV in America and the number one morning radio show in Canada. There was also a huge amount of online press from outlets such as The Raw Story, Vice, Gawker, Salon, New York Observer, International Business Times, Village Voice, Counterpunch, Jezebel, and countless others from around the world. There were even some big counter-protests that helped gain us publicity. Many people thought that pro-white activists had a snowball's chance in hell of getting any mainstream coverage of our issues, but we proved them wrong with the White Man March, Hunt said. Now this snowball is rolling and creating an avalanche of support. Of course, much of the media coverage coming from the establishment and pseudo-alternative media outlets was biased and hostile to the message and goals of the White Man March promoted by Hunt and his supporters. Although much of the coverage was not portraying us in a favorable light, these stories were all well-read, shared, and commented upon, meaning a massive amount of new people have been exposed to our message, Hunt said. We have forced white genocide into the public consciousness. Many view the White Man March as the continuation and expansion of a global pro-white movement and racial awakening. Hunt and other pro-white activists who support and participated in the march have big plans moving forward. This is a little bit sad because we did let up. I did let up. We cannot let up at such a critical time, Hunt explained. We are forcing the media, politicians, and public to pay attention. In order to push our agenda further into the mainstream, we'll be having a White Man March on the third Saturday of every month. We'll continue networking, sharing ideas and inspiration, and refining our tactics moving forward. If we can continue to press this issue, we'll not be ignored and mocked for much longer. We'll keep gaining momentum until we are unstoppable. Strategically, at the time, I wanted to call for a White Man March every month. That would seem like the only real reason that people would show up to the next event. We didn't let up. After this, we had a big showing in the next White Man March, just big in a different way. And perhaps, was not going to be as memorable as the first one. But there is another White Man March that's coming up. I'm not even organizing this one. It's just started to happen. Pretty sure it's March 21st, 2015. Here's the last paragraph of that article. Robert Ransdell, a participant in Florence, Ohio, spoke with Cincinnati's The Inquirer, a division of Gannett covering the Buckeye State, explaining why he was participating in the march. We are here promoting white interests and encouraging others to stand up for people advocating for the white majority, just like the minorities are encouraged to do, Ransdell was quoted as saying. Robert Ransdell. Met him in person. That was great, being out there filming Renegades in America, meeting Robert Ransdell. He had quite a year as well after the White Man March. With Jews, we lose. Getting that slogan international. Yes. All right. That's it for that segment there. You know what? I'm going to play a little bit of music. Just a little bit of music. And then maybe take your calls. Talk about some of the other big stories throughout the year. And get into some predictions. So here we go. We're going to play some more Rotter Sand tonight. Hour number two of the Solar Storm. Welcome back. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you this 28th of December, the last Solar Storm of 2014. Big things happened in 2014. Are we going to see bigger things in 2015? Inevitably. Calls, 347-633-9657. Let me know what you think of 2014 and what you have in store for 2015. What you think you'll do or what you see coming. Let's go to the mainstream's view on 2014. This is ABC News reporting on Associated Prostitutes. Associated Press story here. The top stories of 2014. The police killings of unarmed blacks in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere. And the investigations and tumultuous protests they inspired was the top news story of 2014, according to the Associated Press annual poll of U.S. editors and news directors. In a year crowded with dramatic and often wrenching news developments around the world, the number two story was the devastating outbreak of Ebola in West Africa, followed by the conflict in Iraq and Syria, fueled by the brutal actions of Islamic State militants. Dun, dun, dun. Who the United States funded? No? Oh. Among the 85 voters casting ballots, first-place votes were spread among 15 different stories. The Ferguson entry received 22 first-place votes, Ebola 11, and the Islamic State story 12. Okay, more about the voting and conducted, blah, blah, blah. This news story sucks. Cygirl wants me to add her as a contact on Skype. I will accept. Okay, here we go. Cygirl, if you want to get on, just shoot me a message saying so. Police killings. Number one, some witnesses said 18-year-old Michael Brown has hands up in surrender. Others said he was making a charge, but there was no dispute. He was an unarmed teen. I added a little bit in there by accident. Okay, Cygirl wants to come on. I'll get to those stories in just a bit. I'm going to... Hello, Cygirl, are you there?
Yeah, let me turn down...
Yes, turn down the speakers.
Yeah.
Welcome, Cygirl.
Well, I think, you know, reflecting on the year past, one can't help but be impressed by the growth and the, I would say, success of Renegade Broadcasting and other venues. I'm thinking in particular of Horace the Avenger and his White Rabbit project, which, you know, has or for that matter, just the rise. You know, it cannot be denied now. This is a significant historical development, that is to say, the rise of what might be referred to as white nationalist or European nationalist movements. It has a somewhat different character in Europe, where I think in Europe it has stronger roots. Here, because of the complexities and the uniqueness of American society, it's more like a locomotive slowly gathering steam. It doesn't have the explosive force that we've seen in places like Greece with the Golden Dawn or in Eastern Europe and so forth. But I don't need to tell you this. You're very familiar with it all. I just wanted to point it out. I think it's...
Yeah, I'll be actually getting to the nationalist uprising around the world, actually, not just Europe, in 2014. This is going to have huge shockwaves that we're going to see in 2015. Do you see this as all getting bigger and bigger?
I see it as getting huge, and I see it as intersecting or colliding with a catastrophic loss of confidence in all institutions, financial, commercial, cultural, academic, and especially in what we what we call the mainstream media, I predict that in a year or two, that notion itself is going to rapidly become obsolete. The notion mainstream media will become an oxymoron because it really will no longer have a majority viewing or listening audience.
I agree completely. It's amazing to see how quickly a lot of readers out there have put their faith into the non-traditional, the up-and-coming media outlets online that are not completely owned by Jews. Because now, with the different technologies that we have at our disposal, a couple people can pretty much run a news site that competes with these massive organizations. And they've been laying people off left and right because they're just not getting the same ad dollars that they once were because all of their traffic is being directed elsewhere. The alternative media has made huge steps in looking professional and also becoming just a bit more polished in terms of style and content, I'd say. So it's interesting to watch this unfold where more and more people are not just not getting newspapers, but then not going to the New York Times or buying any of these subscriptions to these failing institutions.
I see YouTube videos, extended documentaries, or just to point to the most recent one that's gone viral, we need to talk about Sandy Hook, which is, I guess, the result of a sort of media collective people. But professionally speaking, it's, to me, you know, they used to have an Academy Awards. I know that's completely Hollywood, which is to say Jewish dominated, but you know, historically everybody used to tune in and watch the Academy Awards and watch these gold-plated statues be awarded, and they always gave an award for the best documentary. And when I see the documentaries that have been produced on YouTube, to me, they make the stuff on the television networks look like cheap, sloppy crap, not just content-wise, but in terms of production values as well, and in terms of not insulting your intelligence. So across a broad spectrum, we're going to be seeing, I think, sort of a, I don't want to call it a revolution in consciousness, but certainly a crisis or a catastrophic break in Weltanschauung. Can I use that word, Weltanschauung?
Sure, yes. Well, let's just consider, you know, the professional anti-racists, the people who are just talking about how we're the most hateful people in the world. These people might have a few people come by their hate watch, their blogs, and comment on their articles. Very few people are actively engaged without being paid in the anti-racist struggle. Sure, a lot of people are engaged in the anti-white struggle in terms of just racist the people going after the racist white people. And these would be the militant blacks and La Raza people. But they're actually being paid oftentimes with U.S. tax dollars. That's the sad part about it. But what I was getting to is that the professional anti-racists are doing so much worse in terms of generating interest and bring people together than the people that they claim to be racist, people with blogs out there, with news sites, with – I mean, the comments are, you know, in the hundreds oftentimes on these outlets, and we've got so many of them, whereas there are just so few of the people who are against us. It's pretty encouraging when you really look at it that way.
The elements that you refer to, and I kind of hate using that anti, you know, we can get into a whole discussion about how redefining the language is going to be a key strategic thing for taking the high ground. You see how much the language has been distorted and perverted because, of course, the term anti-racist is really code language for anti-white or anti-European. I think we know that. And in a sense, that whole way of speaking and thinking, since language is used to organize conscious thought, you're going to have to build a new language or completely redefine the existing one. And we sort of see that underway.
Well, I think they need to we need to take away the power of their words. We should have people laughing when they're called white supremacists, told that they have white privilege. We need to make these weapons completely dulled to the point where they're just not even usable, that they won't use white privilege and white supremacists against us anymore. They actually don't use racists against us as much as they used to. So they're continually having to try out different things to be able to discredit us, and less success they're having.
What holds them afloat is money. They do not have, I don't think they have the sort of cadre commitment or mass following I think it's basically, it's almost like sort of one of those Hollywood screen facades, right? It's sort of two-dimensional.
Right.
When you're Great. Looking at groups like the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they do have muscle behind them, and that, of course, is in the guns of the FBI and the BATF, Department of Homeland Security, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, this rapidly growing police state apparatus. But there again, that doesn't seem to have a strong ideological base. To me, what's holding that up is money, jobs, grants.
Yeah.
And then you've got the NGOs, which are completely – and those are the things you're really going to have to watch out for. Phony revolutionaries. And, you know, when you talked about so-called the anti-racist icon, right away what popped into my head was this image of Russell Brand.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, isn't he the sort of quintessential voice and image of that whole worldview? That's what they've got to use to co-opt maybe, you know, Occupy Wall Street or whoever else is showing up for that kind of thing, you know, what used to be called the left.
Now, you mentioned before all the guns that the anti-racists have had at their disposal. Do you think that some of these guns, or rather the people holding these guns, are going to start to question what these anti-racist motives really are when they're seeing it being put out there that what they want is dead cops? You know, that march in New York City where they're chanting for more dead cops. And when you're seeing these have real life results where policemen are being killed, well, if I was working for some kind of hate watch group or working on hate crimes in the FBI, I'd start to try to, you know, put two and two together and see who was really causing this violence. It's what I'm trying to say is it should just be so obvious what's going on now, that some of these people working in the different bureaucracies have got to be either throwing up their hands and saying, what the hell am I going to do, or actively trying to find a way to stop this race war from getting even more violent.
I've seen evidence here in Baltimore that the local Fox affiliate, WBFF, edited the audio of demonstrators who were shouting something like jail killer cops to sound like kill cops. Now, I don't know if that's what happened in the case of the demonstration up in New York City, but I wouldn't underestimate the efforts of the media and those with a race war agenda out there to hoax us, to fool us. I've started looking at the details of this alleged cop shooting in New York City. And, of course, I was suspicious of it right away when the two alleged victim cops happened to be Hispanic and Chinese. The Chinese guy apparently has family in mainland, which is to say communist China. And I, the more I looked at it, the more skeptical I became. So I guess you put me in the camp of those people who don't really believe much of what is currently reported.
Sure. I mean, that at this point is almost it's almost irrelevant to me whether or not these events are taking place or whether or not the media is just fabricating the whole thing, because the intention is still there. They're still trying to stoke a massive race war with what they're doing in their coverage of Ferguson, in their coverage of all these different stories, going back to Trayvon Martin and well before that. And I think more and more people are starting to recognize this. You know, with that agent, the DHS agent in charge of buying weapons and ammunition for the Department of Homeland Security, with it coming out that he had this site war on the horizon where he's saying that black people are going to have to kill a whole lot of white people, innocent white people. Not just the ones that they deem racist, but everybody. And, well, I mean, it starts to add up to a pretty horrid picture. So I would think that if there are some white agents out there who are assigned to listen to people like myself, that they start to say, hey, you know what? I don't want my children to be slaughtered. I don't want my wife to be raped. No, I'm not going to be part of this. I'm hoping that would be the case, that these guys have some sense to actually look at the freaking evidence. What I've been doing with my shows is compiling a shitload of evidence. And there's enough to basically, not convict, I'd say, but to put a very compelling case against a whole lot of people for very massive crimes. And this is what a lot of people in the alternative research community are doing, of course. But us collectively, we've assembled what would be such an incredible court case, or many court cases. Don't you agree? When is this justice going to be enacted? Did I lose Cygirl?
Okay. I think you have a useful insight there in the idea that whether these events are actually occurring or whether they're contrived and engineered or whether they're completely fabricated by the controlled Zionist media is, in a sense, second, not quite irrelevant, but certainly secondary to the agendas that are being pursued. As symbolic events, clearly there's a message in each one of them, and there's an agenda behind it. My concern is that people not be diverted or have their energies channeled and broken up and sort of have their forces divided, going after what I consider pawns or rooks.
No way. Tyrone with the 75 IQ is the mastermind behind all of this. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I think what has been taking place is that the establishment, this international cadre, has felt very threatened in this past year and are seeing that they're coming under further scrutiny and attack. So what they're doing is unleashing their foot soldiers. It would basically be like the Asians, the Mongols to the communists. They obviously weren't their best and brightest of soldiers, but they'll get in there and get dirty and get the job done. That's basically what I see taking place in the United States with the Mexican invasion and the black uprising. It's basically communist in nature and anti-white as well, to be sure.
Well, this is definitely top-down social engineering that involves importing immigrants, usually completely illegally, in order to dilute, water down populations in certain areas. We've seen it very heavily in the South. They moved a lot of Mexicans and Latinos into the South, into traditional small towns. The intention is to sort of have a corrosive effect on the traditional values, cultures of these communities. I don't know what we can do to resist that. I mean, I know, you know, there was an effort at one point to try to, you had the Minuteman group at the border, and we could see how that was sort of manipulated into a kind of an anti-Hispanic. I mean, it was smeared and slandered. An anti-Hispanic movement.
That's just really trying to chop off the tentacles of the beast. You've got to go for the head or the heart. You've got to lop off the head or stab through the heart. You can't just be fighting the tentacles all day, you're going to get nowhere. Basically, we could take care of the black problem, the Mexican problem, and a whole lot of other problems if we didn't have the vampire problem.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much what I was getting at. You have to concentrate your fire and your resources, and you know, and over time your resources will grow, obviously. But what is logistics? What is warfare? It's the most efficient use of your available resources to most effectively target your primary enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Yeah, I think you kind of got the drift of that. That it's about the elites at the top who are manipulating the situation. And like I say, I keep coming back to this. You know, now's a great time to target the media and control the media. And I don't just mean so-called news coverage. I'm talking big time about so-called entertainment, cable TV and movies,
mm-hmm.
to target that as almost, you know, as maybe in a way more important than the bankers or the generals or the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And the
media is so familiar to everybody, whereas
right.
The mass people out there who aren't all dumbasses but just need a little push in the right direction, they don't know all these different names that some of us have been researching for years, but they do know about popular culture and the media. So that would be a good way to get through to them.
At the same time, I think you have to have a long-term perspective of what I would call cadre development.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you're not looking to get rich quick in the sense of bringing in masses and masses of people. That happens of its own. That's a almost an independent historical tendency when masses start moving.
Yeah.
It's about preparing yourself and your cadres for that decisive historical moment. And that's about education. And so I think one of your priorities this year in 2015 should be to continue to elevate the intellectual to give your movement more and more class.
Nah.
You know, to bring in more and more articulate, you know, people of the caliber of, say, Professor Kevin MacDonald, you know, people who can clearly articulate your perspective in a way that can't be argued with, in a way that has intellectual integrity.
Mm-hmm. Bold truth arguments. And we have those available to us. A lot of them have been written down. It's just that it's hard for people when speaking in a short interview or you know, trying to put together a two-hour program to put it all together in a great way. I mean, people have been working on this, but we really should refine our talking points down to something that it's kind of like the mantra. You know how they always use the mantra? We need to come up with this and then just translate it into memes. It's already taking place. But to get people on a consistent message is very important, I think, because if you find a weak spot and you just keep hitting it and hitting it and hitting it, it's going to break.
Yeah, movements develop on two levels. The level that you're talking about there with coming up with a simple, very simple programmatic statement. Yeah, that's the masses. That's the people who, how do I put this, who are not, they're not going to be won over intellectually. They're going to be predisposed to look for a potentially winning movement that has mm-hmm. their interests at stake. Yeah, definitely that's happening at a certain level. But I'm also talking about, you know, leadership, the development of leadership and the leadership principle. This is something you guys, I think, need to look at more closely. Now, I look at your trajectory. I remember listening to you from almost the first radio broadcast you did over at Oracle. You know, over the years, I've kind of listened to you mature. And obviously, you've done a lot more reading. You know, you're really getting seriously into this. And that's the sort of intellectual rigor and toughness that I think you're going to need at the top. You're going to need people who are not going to allow their emotions or their biases to jaundice the ruthless objectivity of their strategic judgment. You know
well,
what I mean?
Well put. That's well put. How about this? How about I go through the rest of the AP's news stories here? I'll just read the title of each one, the item. So first was the police killings. You know, they're saying that they of course put the statement that some witnesses said that Michael Brown had his hands up in surrender first, and then said, well, others said he was making a charge. So the media has pretty much been fairly lopsided with that story in pushing Michael Brown as a completely innocent victim, you know, with all the different liberal commentators putting their hands up in a similar gesture. And they also had an I Can't Breathe sign referencing Eric Garner.
So you had the NFL
right.
players of the
yeah.
St. Louis Rams with that
yeah.
gesture, sure.
So that was a big story, that's for sure.
Yeah,
go ahead.
When I confront people with that, because you see what's happening there. Right away, they want to make it about, they want to play the race card.
Mm-hmm.
And my reply to that is, why are we even talking about this? If Mike Brown had been white and Darren Wilson black, we wouldn't even know they existed.
Well, there was a story that was basically just what you said, with a black cop shooting an unarmed white teen, that got no international coverage, got no national coverage, barely got any local coverage. So it's a case of the dog bites man story doesn't get a lot of media attention, whereas the man bites dog story does. White on black crime or white on black killing is so disproportionate to black on white killing that, you know, if there's going to be any instance of a white person killing a black man in this country, you're going to see it all over the press, especially because they have an agenda, but also because it's rare and they want to use this as a good example. Whereas blacks killing blacks or blacks killing whites, hey, it happens all the damn time. That's not news.
Yeah, my thinking on that is you kind of want to deflect that race argument because, I mean, really, does the white nationalist movement really have a stake, a political stake, in getting caught up in the argument between black thugs and militarized cops?
No, I don't think that we do have much of a stake there, but I do think it is good that police are being pushed by our enemies into our way of thinking. I think more and more are. I think that they have actually been racially aware, many of them, since the first year on the job. That's their training day. You know Training Day, the movie?
Sure.
That's basically what they probably have to go through, realizing that the black cop they're working with might not be all that upstanding, or rather that the black community that they're supposed to be protecting and serving wants to kill them, listens to rap music about killing them, and is largely involved in criminal activities and not too much that's productive. So
what do you expect to happen in those cities where police departments are managed and led and even heavily staffed by black cops, like where I am here in Baltimore, Maryland?
I'd say it might not.
Or Washington, D.C.
Hopefully they're honorable people. Hopefully those are honorable policemen, and they won't be siding with black thugs. I hope that's the case. But I think that racial loyalties go so deep, pretty much for anybody besides white people, but of course that's changing, that race comes first. And that's the way a lot of black policemen will start to view things. I think that's the way a lot of white policemen will start to view things as well. That's the nature of this race war that's been imposed on us.
So your strategic approach to that is essentially you think you're going to split.
I'm not trying to split police forces. I just think that that's what's going to happen.
Hmm.
I think that that's inevitable. I do think that there will be a number of white policemen who really do feel sorry for the blacks and are, you know, I don't know, still caught up in that kind of mindset. But there are going to be, and there are also going to be a lot of black policemen, I think, who are going to say, hey, you know what? What's going on here is not right. It's not lawful. And I don't want to see white people get murdered under my, you know, under my watch. So there are going to be good people like those black people who don't let white people get murdered because it's the politically correct thing to do. I hope that's the case. But
well, there's so much residual hostility toward police forces as a consequence of, for example, the drug war or no-knock warrants.
They have a brotherhood of their own, so I don't think that they will be completely divided. I think that the police force might actually stay somewhat intact. They just might realize or get a little bit wise to what is taking place at the federal level. And even people within the federal bureaucracies, I think, are going to start to really question what it is they're doing. I think they already have been.
And you see prospects for recruiting individuals from out of those layers.
I want them to stay in those layers.
Well, right.
I honestly think that people are getting fed up at every level. When you see the average people on the street with very little intel getting fed up, what do you think is going to be the case with people with a lot of intel?
Yeah, yeah. I guess I hadn't thought about it that way. At the point that their paychecks start to bounce.
Well, that's why they should be in. They shouldn't make themselves too widely known. But in any event, let's move on from that just a little bit and discuss the next story here. And we could stay as long on any of these topics as need be, but we could also just breeze through them. Next one here is Ebola, the Ebola outbreak. This is another one that I've seen some convincing evidence to suggest that much of this is exaggerated or could even be considered a hoax. What about this Ebola outbreak, which was, you know, so in your face for months and months and months, and then it just disappeared?
I noticed everybody's commenting on that, how within the last couple of weeks, all of a sudden, Ebola is gone. And so are we supposed to believe that the outbreak in West Africa was somehow exaggerated?
Or that they're hiding the fact that Ebola is spreading everywhere. We got the Walking Dead on our hands. I think that it's probably the former rather than the latter. I think that it was completely overblown, like the H1N1, like swine flu, like bird flu, like mad cow disease, or whatever else the CDC is using to sell vaccines.
But you will concede that in West Africa itself, in Sierra Leone, Senegal, Liberia, even in Nigeria, there is deep, deep suspicion of UNESCO, the Red Cross, vaccinations, and also that Obama's deployment of troops. I mean, Ebola essentially became a pretext for the, you know, more permanent deployment of troops and military units to West Africa. That seems to be the agenda that's advanced here, whether the Ebola is real or not.
Mm-hmm. And then the next story is tied in oftentimes. It was used in these two stories were used in the same sentence in one of Obama's speeches. ISIS, the Islamic State, out of nowhere, after their attempt to wage war against Syria at a larger level failed, the administration seems to have come up with ISIS out of nowhere. What do you think about the Islamic State?
Well, you know, ISIS was suspected of being a Mossad operation from the beginning.
Well, yeah, years ago they said that the acronym for the Mossad could be ISIS.
Yeah.
There's a YouTube clip of it. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right, by deception. We've gotten increasing, you know, there's not a day that goes by there isn't confirmation that they've been armed and trained and organized and financed by NATO. That, in fact, Israeli real estate developers are buying up property in ISIS-controlled areas of Iraq and Syria.
Boy, they.
That was reported within the last week. And we even think we've identified, one of the caliphs, one of the leaders of ISIS, as an Israeli, as a Mossad agent himself. So I think the skepticism about the authenticity of this Islamic State, rather than it simply being another mercenary arm of NATO and the Zionists, I don't think people have too many illusions about that at this point. And concurrent with that, people realize that the effort to topple the Assad government in Syria is driven by considerations of pipelines and the fact that Syria remains outside the control of the global banking community that dominates just about everybody. Mm-hmm. So I think people have a pretty clear understanding of that.
And Assad is a proud white man with blue eyes. They don't want that. Some people would consider him white, but he looks white to me, along with his wife.
Well, you shouldn't let external appearances.
I know, but he does seem to be an honorable leader, a good leader for Syria.
Well, we could move on to this question. I would think that the policy issue that white nationalists would have the most difficulty with is the situation in the Ukraine, because of the fact
yes.
that this rump phony regime that was put in power by the U.S. State Department, essentially.
Yeah, that was one of the stories. So we'll just skip that one later when I go through it. The Ukraine. Yeah, Ukraine has these supposed neo-Nazis and alleged pro-whites fighting against the evil Soviet Putin. And that sounds pretty good to me, but when you realize that it was Jews funding and fighting in some of these conflicts, you start to question things.
Yeah, that's what I mean about looking at the hand behind the foot soldiers. You know, the directing powers, they can put somebody out there and make them look like anything they want. They can make them look white. They can make them look like an Arab. They can make them look, you know what I'm saying? They can make them look Aryan if they want.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you have to look at, well, first of all, you got to follow the money and see who's financing it. That right away will tell you who's behind it, because you know, almost always it's Zionist banking money that's behind it.
Well, that's exactly the case for the number four story here. The U.S. elections on both sides of the aisle, you will find that all candidates, Republican and Democrat, have to basically pledge undying support for Israel. They put Israel first. They're Israel firsters. If they want any kind of campaign cash, they have to say that they will never cut funding for Israel. While at home, hey, let's cut everything. Let's cut this, let's cut that. We'll grow the largesse of this monstrosity of a government and take from the people to do so. Or we'll redistribute wealth, the majority of it to the international Jews and their friends and their lackeys. But we'll give a little bit to the illegal immigrants. We'll give a little bit to the blacks. We'll give a little bit to this revolutionary organization. This is the nature of U.S. politics. So the U.S. elections, big midterm elections. Sagro, what do you think about this Republican Party bringing back conservative values, pro-white values to the country by gaining control of the Congress?
Well, you know I'm always skeptical of these so-called elections. It was Stalin who observed that elections belong to those who count the votes rather than those who cast them.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with die-bold electronic machines, I'm always a little skeptical about the reported results. I did take note of the fact that a large number of candidates on both sides receive financing from casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who I believe is a dual citizen of Israel.
Yeah, I think so.
So it can, and it's being said over there at at Veterans Today, it's being said that Adelson essentially owns that Congress. So who knows what, you know, he's probably got half of them bribed, the other half blackmailed.
Well, what was the first thing that was done basically by the Republicans after gaining control? They basically legitimized amnesty and funded Obamacare. Oh, wow, really, really sticking up for the constituents, huh?
Well, they claimed they had to do that so they wouldn't be held accountable for paralyzed. You know, they've got to get that budget through or else supposedly government services will you know that game, how that works. You know,
We couldn't do anything about it. We're so sorry. Yeah.
Right, but you know something? That really gives you an opportunity to target their political base.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to show how worn out and impotent and dishonest and cowardly the Republican Party leadership is and how it's completely bought off and subservient to foreign interests, principally Israel, although I also see a lot of Chinese money involved. This Sandy Hook thing, it really stunned me to find out that Malloy, the governor, had made a trip to China and that he was counting on millions of dollars of investment coming into Connecticut.
Hmm.
So, of course, while I'm well aware of the Israeli connection through people like the Posners and others to the Department of Homeland Security training exercises that preceded Sandy Hook, I was also very intrigued to see how many Chinese names were showing up in some of these joint community partnership organizations that have been set up between Newtown and a corresponding city in mainland China. So my thinking on it is that they're behind schedule in terms of harmonizing United States law with respect to private firearms ownership. Now think about this.
Yeah.
They're counting on the Chinese to bail them out, to bail out U.S. Treasury bonds, to bail out the petrodollar. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to let the Chinese buy up huge chunks of commercial and residential real estate here in the United States.
Now, do you think that they're going to have lots of Chinese move in, or do you think that it's just going to be somewhat hidden where China's making a lot of money off of this ownership?
I went out to look at the details on a project at George Mason University called Caesar II, Effects-Based Operations. And it was a fully automated software package that basically was able to monitor enemy, you know, what are the effects, what are the psychological effects on a designated adversary or enemy from one or another tactic. So in other words, it's like you gather the data to see what the effect is, and then you either turn up the heat or turn it down or calibrate it depending on what the effects have been. So they're able to monitor this in a real-time basis. And I started looking at the names of the scientists who had developed this thing. And at the top was a guy named Alexander H. Levis, L-E-V-I-S. I don't think we need to identify his ethnic affiliation.
Yeah.
But most of the other names, the graduates who were working with him on this were Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
It would appear that the Chinese communists have sent some of their top researchers and scientists here to the United States to help us bring our customs and laws more in harmony with that of the international community and the Chinese communists with respect to firearms ownership, private firearms ownership.
Mm-hmm. I've dealt with this in some of the videos I made a while ago about our special relationship with China. They lit up the Empire State Building, the Chinese colors, to mark their anniversary a few years ago. That's pretty incredible. Obama has just made all sorts of – he bowed to China. One of his first things that he did when he was in office, he's made it clear that China is a very strategic partner and actually showed subservience to them. And I think that Eric Holder's statement from the 90s saying that we really need to brainwash people about the way that they think about guns really ties into what happened at Sandy Hook, to be certain. Now, Cygirl, anything else you'd like to add on this before we move through this list a little bit more?
Well, just as you say, don't underestimate the role of the Chinese in this. I see the Jewish bankers acting as middlemen and enablers. They're negotiating these deals. They're setting them up, and they're making assurances and promises to the Chinese that as they move in and take over real estate here in the United States, that somehow or other we're going to bring our gun problem, as they view it, under control. After all, if you are a Chinese communist bureaucrat getting ready to sign off on billions of investment in the United States, wouldn't you want some assurances to secure your investment that the American
yes.
people would be disarmed?
Yes. Red Dawn would be the scenario otherwise, like the original movie.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going on here. Yeah, as well as just full-scale economic and cultural integration of economies.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the next topic has anything to do with this? Obamacare.
Well, for me, Obamacare was simply TARP for the health insurance industry. You remember TARP, the mm-hmm. Troubled Asset Relief Program, where the American people were essentially shaken down by Goldman Sachs and Shearson Lehman and the others.
But think about the complete control over everybody's health care, what that would enable a government like China, where people's organs are harvested right on the spot, all from prisoners, and sold to wealthy people who need, say, a liver transplant. This is very worrisome when you consider communist Obamacare and what that could really be all about. You know, we've been hearing about death panels for a while. This seems like it's another way just to completely control us and also potentially kill us.
Yeah, Obamacare clearly is an effort to harmonize the American healthcare system with the international community, which, as you know, if you're talking about Europe and China, basically you're talking about state-run medical systems, while at the same time preserving the solvency of these large insurance companies, which otherwise might have gone under.
Mm, yes. Let's go.
So it has a dual aspect. That's the conservative side of it.
Yeah.
conservative side of it is bailing out the insurance industry, especially AIG and Maurice Greenberg.
Let's go to the next one. I really didn't care about this one at the time, and I don't care much about it now, but there has been another missing Asian plane, the Malaysia Airlines mystery. What do you think about this?
Well, to me, it's pretty clear why. I mean, who would have a motive to attack the Malaysian National Airlines? What is Malaysia known for? They're one of the few countries that has hosted hearings on 9/11, has identified Israel's involvement in the perpetration of the 9/11 false flag attacks. The former prime minister of Malaysia, Mohammad Mahathir, has spoken very, very frankly about the nature of Jewish financial power internationally and the sort of stranglehold that it has over third world development. He's spoken very frankly about this.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, been denounced by papers like the New York Times and so forth for this. So on several counts, the Malaysians have stood up, have swam against the current in terms of Zionist control over the narrative of the war on terror. And so they're being punished accordingly. That's my view of it.
So you think that this, they really were the passengers on the plane and that they were just, they were taken out and maybe even taken down and tortured. That's what some people think. What happened to the guy from the John Birch Society years ago?
Larry McDonald.
Yeah, that's the one.
Right.
When he his plane got shot down over the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, I thought that was the Korean airliner, right?
I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it looks to me like a real plane was shot down, but it looks like it was shot down by the Ukrainians and not by the Russians.
Okay, interesting. Next big topic here, immigration. Anything further to say on immigration? The deluge is has really kicked in here. We're being flooded, and immigration, legal but especially illegal, is now one of the most important topics on the minds of most Americans who are paying attention. What do you see about this?
Well, you know, I take Henrik Palmgren's view of this. It's top-down social engineering along the lines of Count Kalergi. In Europe, they're accomplishing it by moving in African and Middle Eastern populations, and here they're using Latinos and Asians to water down the native population of the United States. So, yeah, they're moving very aggressively. They're almost rushing to this, I think.
I think they're going too fast, but
yes.
maybe that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to enact it so quickly that once it's done, there's little we can do about it. As you said before, what the hell are we going to do with millions and millions and millions of people that are now in the land? Are we supposed to, as nationalists with very small numbers, go out there and try to round them up and send them back? No, obviously not. We can't
do that. Yeah, this is where real leadership and real strategic thinking is going to be called for. Because you realize these immigrant populations, they bring them in, they're completely beholden to the federal government or to the NGOs that are sponsoring them and that are financing them, the charities, whatever. And they're going to do whatever they're, you know, for the most part, they're not going to act based on any principle. They're going to do what they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you don't want them to be able to use this immigrant population against the native white population. I mean, we don't want to allow a situation like that to be engineered in the same way as they're attempting to engineer a black-white race war. It's simply not to your advantage. You understand?
Yeah.
It's not to your advantage to be using up your resources fighting the immigrants when, in fact, it's the puppet masters and social engineers at the top who you want to isolate and destroy.
Mm, yeah.
And then you can deal with the immigrant you can deal with the immigration issue on a different level.
Yes.
You may at some point actually have to be negotiating with some of these groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what responsible political leadership is.
Right.
The white nationalist movement may in fact need to be forming temporary alliances, agreements, non-aggression pacts, if you will. You can look at the Hitler-Stalin pact and study that if you like,
mm-hmm.
as an example. Or you can look at the cooperation between the German National Socialists and the KPD, the German Communists.
The Zionists, too. They worked with the Zionists to get
Germany. I'm thinking in particular of the Berlin transit strike of 1931-32, where, you know, National Socialists, Communists, and Social Democrats – all work together to support that strike. And as a consequence, the National Socialists walked away with a lot of new members. So,
right. Yeah.
I think it's something, you know, you can't react to these situations viscerally or emotionally. You got to be real cold-blooded about it and strategic.
I agree. The next one, I think, is another one of these complete distraction issues that we shouldn't be dealing with whatsoever, expending our efforts towards trying to combat it. Gay marriage. They threw in gay marriage as one of the top stories of 2014. I mean, they're trying to shove gays in our face every way they can. That's all that this is. I don't see it as an important story of this year. Do you?
Yeah, and I know, you know, it's a sensitive topic for a lot of people. And here again, you know, do you want to be swatting flies, or do you want to be taking down, you know, bull, rhinoceros, and elephant? I mean,
And that includes the predatory pederast elite. And one of the guys who really he was quoted as having Obama's ear about this issue was somebody who was found out he's been raping boys.
Yeah, Terry Beam. Terry Beam, his name is, I believe. I danced with Nancy Pelosi at the inaugural ball. Or so. Yeah, I've seen
him. Yeah, he visited the White House many times. So
well, this is useful because, you know, you got to distinguish between the gays and the pedophiles, okay?
Yeah.
They're not the same.
Well unfortunately, they are somewhat
there's an overlap
grouped in together.
There, but
there is a huge overlap, and a lot of the gays, I think, don't like the fact that these pedophiles and NAMBLA and, you know, other organizations make their movement look bad. They don't need any help making themselves look bad with their friggin' parades and other ways that prance around.
Yeah,
but I get what you're saying there.
Yeah, I mean, wherever you can point to pedophilia, child sex trafficking among the elite.
Yeah.
Go ahead and do it.
I think this is one of the big stories of 2014, Westminster.
Right. Jimmy Savile. That's a, you know, big, big story.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this is something that will continue to unfold in the very near future. It's been happening at many different levels in the UK. For example, just how the local police had basically allowed all of those 1,400 little white British girls to be victimized by the – they call them Asians, but they're Pakis pretty much – in Rotherham.
Right. That reminds me of the – you know, the situation in Sweden where they've got an epidemic of rape and apparently – most of the perpetrators are recent Islamic immigrants or the children of Islam, you know, the sons of Islamic immigrants.
Mm-hmm. So I think that we should stick away from just bashing gays and just
right.
making fun of homosexuals every way we can. I don't like the agenda whatsoever. It should not ever be pushed towards children, but that's not our most fruitful battle right now. But anytime
right.
we can take out this predatory elite that's raping children, expose it for what it is, and protect our children, that's obviously our big duty of ours.
Right,
I'd say that's one of our first and foremost duties is to make sure our children and our women are protected. That's primary.
And as intellectual leaders, it's your responsibility to elevate that discussion above mere vulgar name-calling into issues of substance, of dramatic substance. This is not about personal prejudice or name-calling. It's about criminality.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the destruction of cultural values. You have to state this case in world historical terms rather than letting it get personal.
Mm-hmm. Hey, if anybody wants to call in, you have 1 minute and 30 seconds, 347-633-9657. We have one more story here on this AP Top 10 list. It's kind of like the Academy Awards of news stories here. The VA scandal. I don't think this should be considered one of the top 10 stories, but the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, had a big scandal of misconduct and cover-ups and basically allowing veterans to die by not providing them with what they need.
I don't need to tell you that some of the most important people you're going to be recruiting are veterans of these Middle Eastern wars.
And they've known about this for a lot longer than the general public that this is taking place. Some of them are able to get really good benefits from the U.S. taxpayer, but others are really left, you know, hanging out to dry after going and fighting in Zionist wars. They're not useful anymore. Then they're considered terrorists were mentally unstable, mentally unfit to hold a weapon by people like Barbara Boxer. Now, isn't that something? You go and fight in a Zionist war, and hey, you're able to drive a friggin' tank. You're able to shoot a whatever, some kind of high explosive. But once you come back to the United States, Oh, no, that war, it really messed you up psychologically. You can't even have a gun to protect your house. Isn't that something?
Yeah, focus heavily on recruiting in the military and among veterans. That's really a critical group. I mean, if you look at Mussolini's Black Shirt movement or the Stahlhelm, it's absolutely that's a really critical demographic sector. You should orient your rhetoric and your educational material to that group especially.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the leftists in the alternative media, though I don't necessarily consider myself a rightist, those people have somewhat alienated the veterans, I'd say. It's kind of like the movement in the 60s, right? Kind of the hippie movement, calling them baby killers and things. A lot of people, you know, the libertarians might have drawn some. I think that we have a huge amount of strength already from that demographic, and I agree that it's a very important one for us. Yeah, so it turns out in that story, 40 veterans died, or at least 40, while waiting treatment at VA hospitals. So that's...
You might want to consider, and I certainly think white nationalists should be present in demonstrations and in events that veterans have organized in order to demand, proper medical care and decent treatment for what they've gone through. So, yeah, you definitely should be involved in that movement and be supporting their demands, whatever those demands are.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about any stories that didn't make the list that you think should have. What about Bundy Ranch? I thought that was a pretty big story this year.
Yeah, Bundy Ranch was significant, although a lot of people thought it was staged. A lot of people thought it was a setup.
Mm-hmm.
Some people saw provocateurs operating on the ground there. The Bundy Ranch thing is largely about control and ownership of that land. It turns out that west of the Mississippi, huge, huge amounts of land in some of these western states, believe it or not, more land is technically owned by the federal government than by the state or anyone else. So mm-hmm. One of the things that you're going to see emerging this year, and you know, we have institutions like the American Lands Council that is seeking to reclaim these federal territories for the states. This has pretty much already happened east of the Mississippi. At one time, there were a lot of federal territories there, and then as the Indians were driven out, those territories were assimilated into the states. But in the west, there's still huge, you know, whole mountains that are owned by the federal government. And this is going to give an impetus to secession. Look for that on the horizon. This is going to be sort of the middle ground that a lot of these Republicans and Tea Party types resort to, secession. Mm-hmm. You know, the legal, peaceful means to detaching and dissolving your bonds with this tyrannical, corrupt, what do you want me to call it, Zog?
Yeah. Well, let's go global now. Let's talk about some of the big stories in national uprisings around the world. This is a story from iPolitics, and it's titled "The Rise of the Far Right in 2014." Let's just get right into the highlights that they have here. In France, the Front National Party won 12 mayoralties as well as its first victory in a nationwide election, garnering almost 25% of the ballots in the European Parliament vote and taking 24 of France's 74 seats in the legislature. The party leader, Marine Le Pen, is now the frontrunner in the 2017 French presidential election. Now, a lot of people see Marine Le Pen as something of a sellout when compared to her father. What do you think about this situation?
Yeah, I think they may be right about that. And I've also heard that said about this guy that took over the UKIP movement in Britain, that he's essentially sort of a controlled opposition.
Nigel Farage. Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah,
but I think it's a good sign that these people are getting so much support. I think
right.
And
you know, the strategy of the United Front is to form principled alliances with political forces and individuals who you don't necessarily trust, but you want to recruit from their political base.
Mm-hmm.
You want to recruit their following away from them.
Well, I'm going to skip over this next one about India, but there is a Hindu ultra-nationalist organization that's doing pretty well there. That's interesting. Keep an eye on that. Sweden. The far-right Sweden Democrats hold the balance of power in parliament, and this month forced the country's first early election in 50 years. Asked about a local politician who was forced to leave the party for wearing a swastika armband, the party leader Jimmy Akesson replied that the other Swedish political parties have Nazi-sympathizing members, too. They're just more visible in a smaller group. What do you think about the Sweden Democrats? Also a good sign, might not be a party that either of us are ideologically in line with, though.
Well, like I say, it's almost like sort of a first step for a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
To vote for something like that, to start thinking along those lines. And as I see it, it provides a milieu in which more radical organizers can operate. So, you know, I think about it the way I think about something like the Ron Paul movement here, although that's kind of pretty much passé now that he's not around. But I always knew that Ron Paul was controlled opposition, right?
Mm-hmm. I didn't at first. I was younger, though.
Yeah, and I can understand that. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you just stand back and ignore it or you stand aloof from it. No, you get out in there and you distribute your handouts, you talk to people, you discuss, you recruit.
Mm-hmm.
You use it as a milieu in which to recruit, and you tailor your message without sacrificing the basic principles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for example, you know, here in the United States, there's a very strong libertarian tendency, and you're going to have to confront that as against your nationalist inclinations. It's something you're going to have to figure out how to assimilate into a nationalist program, because Americans have sort of a real deep nostalgia for that individual freedom, that sort of rugged individual thing, even though much of it is an illusion.
Libertarian nationalists, the Libertarian National Front or something. Yeah, I think that we do need a way to reach out to them a little bit more. For sure, that's part of the American way, and you won't be able to get Americans in any way, shape, or form looking like 1930s Nazis.
No, we're a different kind of place. But here's an example of my thinking on this. Now I look around. Well, let's take the Mormons for example, the Church of Latter-day Saints. No, I don't subscribe to their theological beliefs or any of that, but I have to concede wherever you go in this country, Mormons are among the best prepared for a breakdown of infrastructure.
Yes.
And a general catastrophe. They're very well prepared, and they happen to be well armed.
Well, some preppers would be better prepared than them, perhaps, but more on an individual level, not a highly networked organization
right.
like the Mormons.
Right, and when you talk about Christians, I might not subscribe to the theology, but I've got to acknowledge the fact that if I know someone is a devout Christian, and I mean an authentic Christian, I'm inclined, and they're patriotic, chances are they're going to be more well-armed and more prepared to use those arms than, say, your average secular liberal.
And possibly less likely to screw you over and kill you
right.
and
right.
rape you or
exactly.
whatever.
Less likely, you know, their personal religious beliefs involve a code of honor and so forth. So, yeah, that's something you have to take into account. And you don't want to offend, you know, you can respectfully hold to your own beliefs, and there's no need to offend their personal beliefs in order to be able to form alliances with them and even recruit them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go on to Hungary here. The far-right party Jobbik did better than ever this year, winning 20% of the vote in the parliamentary election and consolidating its position as Hungary's third biggest party. Jobbik aggressively defended itself against accusations of Nazism, but some of the brave troopers in Heller's picture selection are Jobbik supporters. And one look at them is enough to see what they are. So this article is saying that they're Nazis. Now, Jobbik originally was supporting this conference, the Future of Europe conference, done by Richard Spencer. and had Jared Taylor over there and Tom Sunik and what was the Russian guy who Putin what's his name? I'm drawing a blank right now. The Eurasian guy. He was going to be there too. I can't think of his name right now, but he's not pro-white whatsoever. In any event, Jobbik was supporting this conference and then withdrew their support because, oh, it was, you know, evil, racist, this and that. You know, they're coming under pressure, so they dropped that. But Jobbik is doing pretty well, and a lot of their ideology seems pretty compatible with the way that we're seeing the world. And unfortunately, Jobbik was being led by a Jew for quite some time, and that came out pretty recently. Any thoughts on Jobbik before we move on?
Well, the question is, will Hungary be co-opted into NATO
so that
it can then be used against Russia and Putin?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what this is about. And to me, I wouldn't even pay any attention to the rhetoric of these various different factions.
Alexander really Dugin, by the way, that he wasn't allowed in. Alexander Dugin didn't even make it into the country. That's Putin's
right.
Philosophical comrade, it seems, in many regards.
Yeah, and it's you know, I don't know. NATO is not. What do you want me to say? We know who controls NATO.
Well, we know what General Wesley Clark said when he was chief of NATO. That there's no room in Europe for ethnically pure states. That's the source of the problem. It's a 20th century idea, or actually 19th century or something. Whatever it was, he's saying that that needs to be eliminated. Ethnically pure states have got to go, and he's a Jew. The next one, Japan. 15 of the 19 members of Shinzo Abe's cabinet, formed just a few months ago, are members of Nippon Kaigi, a nationalist group that supports revising Japan's pacifist constitution, considers the 1946 to 1948 Tokyo war crimes tribunals illegitimate, and is generally unapologetic about Japan's role in World War II. Abe, just reelected as prime minister, is going to push for constitutional change to allow Japan to have a standing army for the first time since the days when it was allied to, ready for it, Nazi Germany. So, Shinzo Abe has been something of a nationalist in the past, and it looks like he's making more steps in this direction. Last time he tried anything big, Fukushima happened. What do you think about this now?
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's all pure theater against the backdrop of Fukushima, where they've got that number 4 reactor in full meltdown, irradiating the Pacific Ocean.
So you're under the impression that this is really a big problem that's not being talked about by many people besides maybe Jeff Renz.
Oh, I think people are in serious denial about what's happening at Fukushima. I really do. And you got to
some of the things I see about the Pacific are very alarming.
Oh, yeah. And any effort to sort of remilitarize Japan would only be intended to use those troops as auxiliaries of NATO, right?
Could be. How about Germany? Now, this is somewhat controversial, this latest development in Germany. In Germany, the biggest anti-immigrant protests since the country's unification are taking place in Dresden. This week, 17,500 people turned out against the Islamization of the West, a record for the rapidly growing movement. The rally's organizers, branded pinstripe Nazis by their opponents, deny any ties to the Nazi ideology. Here's how their leader, Lutz Bachmann, frames the distinction. We love our nation, but we are against socialism, so we are not Nazis. So that's an interesting argument. Not condemning the Nazis, just saying, hey, we're not socialists. We're just nationalists.
You know, that's a tricky business, being anything like a national socialist over there. I still remember the murder of Georg Haider in Austria. So, you know, the way I see it, Germany is going to emerge as the heartland of a new Europe. And the German economic relationship with Russia, that's going to come to overwhelm the power of Britain and the United States in Europe.
So,
in a sense, it's kind of strange in a way. The Germans are finally going to achieve the sort of preeminence in Europe that That was the original program of the Third Reich.
But is it going to be something of a brain-dead Germany being led by Jewish forces? Or do you think it's actually going to be a legitimate German nation that throws out invaders and takes control of its destiny?
I think there'll be a struggle for power, but I think the prevailing forces over there, you know, will be what German nationalism.
Mm.
That would be the prevailing force, German nationalism. And it may not even be articulated that way, but it's about German self-interest.
These people are not out there with any kind of anti-Jewish sentiment, at least not openly. But I'd have to imagine that many of these people who are branded pinstripe Nazis are, in fact, Jew-wise, but they're also wise to the laws of their land.
Well, where the rubber's really going to hit the road on this is Germany's relationship with, say, Israel and with the world Zionist organizations.
Well, the leadership that's currently in place, Angela Merkel.
She's on her way out. She's a lame duck.
They're, you know, completely siding with Israel, siding against the protesters. So the official government of Germany is very much coming down against these people.
But I think that's very thin. I think that's very thin. And I think Merkel is she's basically just a placeholder right now. They're going to move her out. And I think they're going to dump the dollar. I think they're going to move to large-scale trade agreements and energy agreements with Russia. I think they're going to become increasingly independent of the West. And I understand that the Germans have just indicted Bush, Cheney, and others for torture. Have you heard this?
I did not hear this.
Yeah, the German – you know, in my view, when I look at the Nuremberg trials and the things that Germany was basically sort of guilt-tripped for after World War II – it seems to me that they're well within their rights to demand that the same standards be applied to war criminals in the United States and Britain and Israel. In fact, in my view, morally, ethically, no one is better strategically positioned than Germany to demand harsh accountability for the crimes that have been committed in the name of the global war on terror. Whether, you know, whether that's in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Gaza, or on the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And that is what I see as the critical role of if Germany wants to lead a new Europe and a new world, this is their task. This is their role. This is their moral responsibility to be a conscience for the civilized world so that these bastards in the American, British, and Israeli elites are held fully accountable for the monstrous crimes that they have committed, which probably far exceed anything that the Third Reich was accused of.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Related, in Austria, the far-right Freedom Party had its best showing in the European Parliament election since 1999, having consolidated after a leadership struggle that nearly killed the party in 2002. We already talked about the UK with UKIP. BNP, they lost their spot in the EU. Nick Griffin stepped down. BNP and the National Front are somewhat of disarray at this point, but they are looking to organize some things in the future. So it'd be interesting to see if they can get any of that UKIP energy back into their camps, or if UKIP is going just to be the kosher alternative that becomes pretty powerful.
Yeah. Nobody should fetishize parliamentary politics. It's nothing but a means to an end.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go. We are talking about Ukraine. That's another one mentioned here. Russia. Okay, this is an interesting one. I want to get your take. In Russia, where the Nazi symbolism of the Ukrainian extreme right is much decried by officials and propaganda outlets, President Vladimir Putin considers no major speech complete without a quote from the writings of Ivan Ilyin, a Russian nationalist philosopher who condoned fascism and praised Hitler in the 1930s. Russia backs far-right movements in Europe and has even openly funded France's Front National. In fact, Russia's new governing ideology is one of extreme nationalism, though it is directed outward, not inward, against perceived external enemies, primarily the U.S., rather than immigrants. What do you think about this?
Well, they say primarily the U.S., but what they really mean are the Rothschild banking interests. This is really who Russia is at war with at this point. And, you know, setting up new currency exchanges, dumping the petrodollar, negotiating energy deals with China. It's clear that the Russians are determined to follow an independent course, and they're not going to be bullied. They're not going to be bullied around Syria. They're not going to be bullied in the Ukraine or around the Crimea. And certainly it makes sense for them to give moral and perhaps even material support to European nationalist parties that want to bust up the rotten, corrupt EU. Brussels needs to be dumped. That whole EU bureaucracy, you know, it's controlled from the top down by these NGOs. Most of them are not even elected, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to the Golden Dawn in Greece. It's not mentioned on this list. They mentioned the Tea Party endorsed candidates in the United States. They say the U.S. extreme conservatives aren't Nazis, but their stance on immigration, for example, is sometimes even more radical than that of the European ultra-nationalist parties. Not Golden Dawn. Golden Dawn is even pro-Nazi in many regards, and many of their leaders can be seen giving the Roman salute, quoting Adolf Hitler, or openly speaking against Jews. And this is why Golden Dawn was declared a criminal organization and two of its members assassinated earlier this year. They've pretty much been railroaded since then. What do you have to say about the situation in Greece with the Golden Dawn?
It's a serious situation in Greece. I mean, people eating out of dumpsters and tremendous numbers of homeless people. Yeah, it's clear they've targeted Golden Dawn because it's created a huge following.
Yeah, they were getting huge. They were going to win a lot of elections.
Yeah, here again, I feel like they kind of got sidetracked into attacking the immigrants instead of the social engineers who are bringing the immigrants in.
Hmm.
You don't want to get trapped into beating up the pawns. You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point, though. It does gain them favor amongst the constituencies when they're seen as protecting the people of Greece.
Yeah.
So it's a fine line to walk, I'd say.
Right. You don't want to be wimps about it, but you want to show that you have discipline, that you're not just a gang. You know, you want to even in a paramilitary sense, at the point that you're able to move in that direction. You want to show that you can impose discipline and that you're well organized, that you're structured, and that, you know what I mean, that you're not just a gangster.
Mm-hmm. Well, Italy has had some big anti-immigrant protests recently. Same advice I'm sure you'd give to them. But any further thoughts on what's taken place in Italy with some of the demonstrations that we've been seeing this past year? I've seen some impressive marches and demonstrations in various parts of Italy. What do you think about this?
Well, you know, Italy is the birthplace of fascism.
Mm-hmm.
With D'Annunzio, Julius Evola, of course, Benito Mussolini. I would say the most influential and important political philosophy of the 20th century, and probably the most prescient. So, you know, I would never second-guess the Italians. There's so much subtlety and complexity to Italian politics, you know. When you look at the traditions there, you know, it's so rich in drama and in color and everything else that I won't second-guess the Italians, you know. I think whatever they're going to do, they're going to do it in an uniquely Italian way.
Mm-hmm. How about we bring it back to the United States a little bit, or rather, you could say, more about exposing the people who control the United States, who control the media of the United States in particular. We've had some big-time celebrities recently speaking out against Jews, exposing Jewish control. This year, we had Gary Oldman, the actor, who came out and in an interview with Playboy put it all on the table about how Jews control Hollywood, and it's pretty much bullshit. That's the short of it. He later apologized on Jimmy Kimmel using basically a scripted apology that Jonah Hill had given on Jimmy Kimmel recently, you know, maybe a couple months prior. So it looked like it was somewhat of a maybe a tongue-in-cheek type of performance there, something that he was obliged to do, showing further that, yes, Jews, of course, control Hollywood, and it's evidenced by the fact that if you criticize their control of Hollywood, they'll say you're never going to work in this town again. What do you think about this getting out there to the mainstream?
Well, this is what the great French philosopher Voltaire said: to discover who rules over you, ask yourself who you're not allowed to criticize. And I remember Marlon Brando, a truly great actor, on the Larry King show, you know, innocently, casually saying, well, everybody knows that the Jews run Hollywood, and boy, did they savage him for that. The thing Gary Oldman reminds me a little bit of what they put Mel Gibson through.
Yeah, another one there. So, I don't know if you caught this story in the past few days. Oliver Stone came out and said that basically Jews, yes, control Hollywood, and they are prohibiting any kind of honest discussion of the Holocaust and putting Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin in their proper context.
I got to check that out now. So Oliver Stone is now becoming a true revisionist historian.
I don't know if I'd say true revisionist historian, or at least what he's saying is not necessarily 100% revisionist, but he's, I think, bringing some people in that general direction.
Hey, look, our position on this is crystal clear. We support and defend free speech and free expression, irrespective of somebody happens to be offended by it. Two, we're not afraid of the truth, no matter how painful it might be. If someone says Jews dominate the legal profession, well, that's true. Jews dominate psychiatry, well, that's true. Jews dominate publishing, well, that's true. Jews dominate Hollywood, that's true. Jews dominate finance and Wall Street, largely true. You know,
here's some quotes here from what he said. The Jewish domination of the media, that's how he referred to it, the Jewish domination of the media. There's a major lobby in the United States. They are hard workers. They stay on top of every comment. The most powerful lobby in Washington. Israel has fucked up the United States foreign policy for years.
Well, you know something? I'm going to find that and post it on my Facebook page because I had no idea he was being that honest.
Yeah. He said that Hitler is always their easy scapegoat.
Yeah. Well, that's very refreshing. But you know something? The fact that Oliver Stone feels secure enough to come out and say this openly shows that the threshold has really moved, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The threshold of allowable discussion has really moved dramatically.
I think he knows if he released a film that was in line with our way of thinking, that millions and millions of people, at least on the internet, who have real money, would be willing to see it.
Well, I thought his effort at Alexander was sort of a kind of a lame attempt at sort of reigniting the mythos of the West.
Yeah. Well,
some people thought it was a little too gay for their taste.
So. Yeah. Well, some people have said that JFK was probably one of the most honest films made about the JFK assassination.
But still
I haven't looked at it in
hangout.
A while.
Still a limited hangout.
Yeah.
From my standpoint, having read, you know, Michael Colin Piper's book, Final Judgment, I feel like maybe Stone didn't go far enough in looking at the, you know, the Meyer Lansky end of things. But, you know, at the time it was, you know, 1991 when it came out, it was a big deal. So yeah, it would be interesting if you could get some really top filmmakers to sort of break the mold in Hollywood and come out with something that really, you know, turns the apple cart over. We may see that yet. We may see that. That may become the next big thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see some films that are somewhat like the Hellstrom documentary I'm making. I think that this is very much in the public consciousness that we've been lied to about World War II. And people are more interested in Adolf Hitler, Nazis, than ever before, and not interested in seeing more Jewish pornography, torture porn, like Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, that was Quentin Tarantino. I've never been a particularly big fan of his stuff anyway, and that was so clumsy and heavy-handed in terms of its agenda. You know, we're living through these drones being fired into villages in Pakistan, you know, killing wedding parties and stuff like that. This is the occasion to remind people of what was done to Germany with that firestorm bombing that basically, I guess, Curtis LeMay came up with, you know, strategic bombing of Germany, which essentially targeted civilian population centers. To me, there's no more appropriate occasion to bring that up, to present it, and to deal with it thoroughly and in great detail so they can throw into perspective the kinds of crimes that are being committed now.
Yep, exactly. It's
by
all
some of the
connected.
Same, by basically some of the same forces.
Well, the people who won World War II have been in power ever since then. And they're doing the same thing over and over again until we're able to stop it. Well, any more thoughts about what could take place as we move into 2015? What do you see on the horizon? Besides
further economic, serious economic suffering. I mean serious economic suffering. Today I read a piece about another city that's kind of gone dark. Infrastructure's breaking down. It's unbelievable to me. Detroit built a new stadium, but they shut off water to whole neighborhoods. Have I got that right?
I think they have built a new stadium. I haven't been paying too much attention to that.
So
but...
you're going to see this weird, crazy discordance between lavish spending on priorities that the elites have set aside at the same time as we're witnessing the crumbling of basic infrastructure in American cities and suburbs. And people are going to be feeling the effects of that.
Mm.
And that's going to further drive the move toward secession and separation from the federal government in Washington, especially in the western states.
Just a quick point, though. Blacks in Detroit didn't pay their bills in mass, and they're expecting that their water wasn't get shut off. If I didn't pay my water bill, I'd be pretty certain that my water would get shut off, and that I wouldn't be able to get the UN to hear my appeal.
Well,
but
what are the
you had the UN stepping in saying it's a human right for these blacks in Detroit to get water, whereas it's not a human right for me?
Well, of course. I mean, but what are the consequences? You know, what's the spillover from that? You understand? We don't want outbreaks of cholera and typhus in American cities because, I guess you know, it'd be pretty difficult to quarantine those cities, to quarantine whole cities. I don't think we want to see a public health catastrophe here in the United States because that would just play into the hands of the elites.
Mm-hmm. I understand. I think that welfare is pretty much bribe money to get these blacks not to riot and loot.
Well, there are no jobs either, are there? I mean, really.
It's a multifaceted problem. Again, if we were to deal with it from the top down, we would be able to handle these things much more effectively. But we've got a bunch of vampires sucking all of our lifeblood, so.
Right. I don't want to blame the slaves. We can criticize the slaves for their stupidity or their violence or their crime against each other. But I don't want to blame them. To me, they're just tools. The blame game is real critical here.
Mm.
Who you blame for the problem is real critical, how you articulate that.
Yeah, and we know who orchestrated the demographic decline and replacement of white people in the United States who enabled all of these blacks to come to positions of power to basically ethnically cleanse Detroit of white people.
You know, in some cases, over the last few years, we've seen predominantly black cities elect white mayors.
Mm-hmm. That was Detroit, for example.
And I saw it here in Baltimore as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't necessarily assume that the entire black community is monolithic. Obviously, they're not.
And they don't like what the Democrats who allegedly support them have done with immigration. A lot of these blacks realize that is completely undercutting their or destroying their ability to get work.
Yeah, what you think of as traditional white American values, I kind of view as traditional American middle class values. So to me, it's possible to articulate those values as middle class rather than as necessarily strictly belonging to one racial group or another.
Well, I think maybe some of those values rubbed off on the blacks who have been living in America for a long time.
And they know that. They know that. Of course. That's why so many of them
live in white neighborhoods. Yeah. And white people usually don't care about those blacks. It's when the rest of them come in, the Section 8, and the ones that I'm sure the few black doctors or the blacks who are actually successful, they hate when these violent Negroes come in selling their crack and hollering at their daughters and whatnot. It's definitely a war on the middle class, and that does include some middle class blacks as well. And I think they're brought down with all of this Ferguson nonsense as well. And they obviously get lumped in together as well because of the tribal attitude of most
blacks. It puts them in a very tricky position. I've lived in the same townhouse neighborhood since 1985. And to be honest, my neighbors on either side happen to be black, African-American.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is a Comcast technician, and the other works up at the hospital. And you know, and their wives have jobs too. And, you know, to me, I don't know, I don't see race as the defining issue between me and them. You know what I mean? I just don't see it that way. Now, obviously, you go into the inner city, you know, into a place like Ferguson, Missouri, and it's obviously a very, very different scenario. But, you know, there's no reason for me to be picking a fight with my middle-class neighbors.
Yeah, you shouldn't go out of your way to cause trouble with them. That's not going to get us anywhere.
Right, but if someone frankly asked me, you know, where my loyalties lie, I consider myself, a European-American. I treasure European values, the traditional values of Western civilization.
Now, a number of estimates have been made recently as to when white people become the minority in America. Saturday Night Live had 2050 set as a date. Recently, there was a Washington Examiner coming out and saying it'll be 2044. This is all in the past year. Some of these are just very recent stories. Vice President Joe Biden was talking to some different Middle Eastern leaders and celebrated that America has such diversity that in 2017, for the first time, Caucasians of European descent, like me, will be in an absolute minority in the United States of America. So that was the U.S. taxpayer paying for Joe Biden to go abroad and celebrate white people becoming the minority in 2017. Some people argue that it's already happened because of the amount of illegals that are not counted and amount of Hispanics, or rather mestizos, that classify themselves as white. But we also had a story this year about how white children are now a minority in the public school systems. So I've seen that diversity is really on a lot of people's minds now. You know, the White Man March really pushed into people's heads that diversity equals white genocide. This program of diversity that is pushed upon us is destroying white people. And then we see all these graphs and charts and everything, and white people are becoming aware now that, wow, we're getting displaced, replaced, and just destroyed. So I think this is very good. What do you think about this this demographic decline becoming such a prominent issue now.
Well, that was obviously Count Kalergi's plan for Europe, certainly. And I'll bet Biden, whether he's aware of it or not, probably fully supports that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. Most Latino immigrants, the Mexicans especially, self-identify as, if you put it to them, they would self-identify as white. I know you're going to say, well, they're Hispanic because maybe their primary language was Spanish. Well, more and more of them speak English. So, and if you put it to them, you know, are you white or colored, they would see themselves, most of the ones I run into see themselves as Caucasian, as white.
I think that's a little bit delusional, but there are obviously a lot of them who identify as the race, as La Raza.
Oh, yeah, that too.
And they have huge loyalties to their own. So even if they consider themselves to be in the larger white race, their ethnic loyalties definitely trump that.
You're not going to push those people out of places like Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California, any more than you're going to push the Cubans out of South Florida. They're there. Now, where perhaps you're building intentional communities in the Northwest, in places like Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Oregon, and Washington State, perhaps there, you know, you may be able to define white Northern European cultural entities, but I just don't see that happening in the Southwest.
It would be difficult at this point, for sure.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to drive those people out. I think it's something you're going to have to come to terms with.
Well, I don't think we should cede lands unnecessarily, but there are strategic steps that should be taken in the near future, and I don't think that one of those strategic steps is to wage war against the mestizos in the Southwest.
Right. At the same time, you know, we can see that Mexico and most of Central America is dissolving into chaos. So, you know, there's nothing. I don't see anything good on the horizon from that. I mean,
well, it would be nice if they had thriving economies. I mean, you can get a lot of these people to go back. But
yes,
that's part of the plan that was put in place with NAFTA, is just to basically destroy these countries and leave them little option other than to go up north to try to actually have a decent life.
Right, and dismantling these rotten globalist trade treaties should be at the top of our agenda.
Well,
at the top of our agenda.
I put it this way. You know, we destroy the globalist power, world Jewish interests, and all their banking schemes and all that, and then we repatriate the refugees. So when we put it in terms of refugees, instead of invaders, which I often like to use, it makes it seem much more humane, like we're actually doing a good thing. In essence, we are.
Repatriation would require some kind of incentive. I mean, you'd have to be prepared to subsidize.
I would do it. If we had control of the United States, or if, let's say, the nationalists in Britain had control of Britain, I think it would be a good move for them to offer a monetary incentive, perhaps even have a piece of land purchased in their country of their birth for them so they could go back to it. I think it'd be worth it in the long run. I think whatever little money had to be spent up front could be easily made by all of the benefits of having a racially cohesive society and having control of their destiny once again, not having it all their wealth sucked off by international bankers. I think that this would be completely feasible.
Yeah, I would say before we take down the bankers, we've got to utterly destroy the power of their media.
Yeah.
Over people's minds.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're one and the same. They're one and the same, but...
Well, Olaf Childress said this in the interview I did with him, that before you take out Zog, you have to take down ZOM, Z-O-M as he calls it, the Zionist Occupied Media.
There it is. That's my, you know, and they're the softest target too. They're the best target. They're the optimal target because They can't hide behind claims of national security secrecy or sovereign immunity or legal contracts or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very vulnerable, and people hate the media as it is. So as far as I'm concerned, you could really play an effective blame game with the media.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, identify the elements that control the media and thus enlighten people about the structure of control of this, the structure of this control, how it works, how it operates. And that in itself is, it changes people fundamentally.
You know, those compilation videos of news anchors saying the same thing over and over. You have one person in a Fox affiliate saying this talking point, you know, something about, oh, Conan O'Brien's pushing the envelope this week. And then another person says, oh, Conan O'Brien pushing the envelope.
Yeah, and reading from scripts. They're reading from scripts.
So when people see this, though, I think that really starts to shake up their worldview a little bit. And they realize, whoa, everybody is being spoon-fed the same bullshit.
Everything we can do to discredit the mainstream media and much of the alternative media as well. Everything we can do is important. It's the most important thing we can do. And like I say, it's on its way out anyway. We have to cash in on that. We have to take the maximum advantage of that. Keep, you know, because people are looking, they're looking for targets. They are. They're looking for somebody to blame for what's happened. And political leadership often is about explaining to people just who's to blame for their situation. It's the blame game. Can you do it effectively? Can you do it efficiently? Can you do it simply and in a manner that's easily understood? Can you provide an accessible target for people's rage? That's really what it's going to come down to.
Yeah, I think so. Now, do you see this coming to real fruition in 2015? Are we going to be able to isolate and sever this structure, sever this head from the body, let's say? Are we going to be able to decapitate the controllers that are ruling over us through their various institutions and start something anew?
It's hard to say. Once things really start to accelerate, once the pace starts to accelerate, then people will know that the process is unstoppable.
I think once one domino falls, the other ones are just soon to come after. I think
one of those
lined
critical dominoes is the dollar, obviously, right?
Yeah. So it will obviously not be pretty for some time as things really unfold. But I think once this really starts to take off, it can be steered perhaps a little bit in this direction or a little bit in that direction, but it's like a bucking bronco that's just going to be unleashed.
It's about, well, as I said before, Weltanschauung, worldview. It's about out of this chaos, because at the ground level, people experience their lives increasingly as chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And so the job of political leadership is to provide a Weltanschauung, a coherent worldview that allows people to explain this process to themselves so they don't go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Or so they don't feel totally helpless. So they've at least got an intellectual handle on what's happening to them. And then from there you begin to build real action, real meaningful mass action. And whether that takes the form of general strikes, insurrection, secession.
I like the way that you've been putting this. People see chaos all around them. It's hard to understand why politicians are doing this or why this program is put in place or why things are falling apart the way that they are. And so they go and they look for answers. They find people who are titled conspiracy theorists looking for some kind of worldview that explains it. And I think that we have the worldview that makes sense out of this chaos, makes it look orderly when you view it from a higher level. And I think that's why more and more people are becoming nationalists. And I see whatever this nationalist rising is, or whatever it is now, it's going to become something completely, not completely different, but it's going to metamorphize. It's going to become much larger. It's going to, I think, also unify in many ways, not necessarily one international group of nationalists, but strong alliances with different nationalist groups helping each other in any way that they can. And I'm just excited about it. I think it's going to be fantastic, but of course it's going to be met with heavy opposition.
I put a lot of emphasis on how you craft the message. That's why I was so impressed by Horace the Avenger and his sort of white rabbit approach to things, because it was so non-threatening, you know?
Hmm.
When you watch these sort of cartoon videos that he's produced and the way he puts it together, you certainly can't accuse him of preaching hate or anything like that. And so to me, it's about crafting that message in a way that's going to make it easier for people to embrace you. And that's a tricky bit. It's something you really have to think about, you know. Obviously, you don't want to be unprincipled. You don't want to sacrifice or water down your message to the point where it becomes meaningless. There is a hard core to what you're about. But you know, the packaging of it, the use of certain words and phrases, or conversely, the deconstruction of certain words and phrases that are used against us. Very, very important. Very, very important. And this is the task of intellectual leadership in any movement.
Sigirl, it's been great having you on tonight. We're running out of time here. I think that your insight has been very helpful for the listeners out there and helpful for myself. So please do think about calling in more to the network. Any final thoughts that you have for 2014?
Well, just that, you know, you've got a really strong start here. I appreciate the level, the intellectual level at which Renegade continues to broadcast, and I hope you guys will continue to maintain those high standards and really, you know, go for the best. Go for the best and the brightest.
No, thank you very much. Sigirl, everybody. Any other calls? Looks like we might have... not looking to come on. So that is it for the night. Since there are just a few more minutes, I'll say my goodbyes and then play us out with a song. Thank you so much for being part of RenegadeBroadcasting.com this year, dear listener or supporter, participant. It has been one tremendous year, and I think we're going to do some incredible things next year. So keep it tuned to RenegadeBroadcasting.com and do whatever you can to further the 14 words. Born. And how
Amen.